There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
I'm hoping the Big Ten has to modify their system for us.
Probably like getting grade 10 sandpaper rubbed on your face every day.
I mean, we say it all the time, whether, you know, there's two types of turds. You're a sinker or you're a floater, but you're still a turd, right? I mean,
we are about players and players playing the plays and not necessarily the plays.
Welcome to the Varsity Club Podcast. My name is Derek Peterson. This week, I am very excited. I do not have him on enough. I am honored, really, to be joined by, you could call him the foremost Husker historian here in this Nebraska media market. You could call him literally a living legend when it comes to storytelling, just Nebraska info in general. Mike Babcock, hello. Thank you for coming on the podcast. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Derek. Thanks for the kind introduction. I think basically I'm old, and I like to say that if you get old enough history, there's nobody around to refute you. So age is a benefit for me there, certainly.
So has there ever been a time where you've just made up something and tried to see if people would go along with it?
No, I have never done that. But I'll tell you, one of the interesting things I've found in dealing with historical matters, even things that have been written at a certain time about the history of, say, Nebraska athletics, are inaccurate. And I'll give you an example. This is my favorite example because it's a very respectable short history of Nebraska football. It's called 50 Years of Football. It was written in 1940 by Frederick Ware, who was the sports editor of the Omaha World Herald. Definitely a legend, Frederick Ware. And in the history that he wrote, he indicated that the coach at Iowa, the University of Iowa, T.U. Lyman, he said, had helped prepare the Nebraska team to play Iowa in 1891. It's the first time those schools played. And that was in his history, and it was carried down through official records and so forth. And I got to looking at that one day, and I thought, you know, that's really interesting, but logistically, how could that happen? So I went back, and I picked up a history of Iowa football, and I'm reading it, and it turns out that T.U. Lyman played football and then coached at Iowa College, which was not the University of Iowa, which was, in fact, in those early years, Iowa's big rival. And Iowa College, I believe it was in Grinnell, had beaten Iowa the two previous years. And so it made sense that T.U. Lyman came to Lincoln and helped prepare the Nebraska team to play Iowa. But there was history that was from a reliable source that was carried down from 1940 all the way into the 70s. I believe the Nebraska media guys, maybe even beyond that, kind of indicated that Lyman had been the Iowa coach and had done this sporting gesture that Frederick Ware had referred to. So even things, and you know, I think over the course of time, I've probably written things that have been inaccurate as well, because you have to be very careful in documenting those kinds of things. But nice off on a tangent. I know that's not what we're going to discuss today.
No, it's interesting because you'll get into an interview with somebody, like say you're writing a feature story about somebody, you'll get into an interview, an enterprise piece or something, and they'll recall a conversation that they had. And then like, say you go back to that same person 10 years down the road and just to catch up or whatever, and you talk to them and they'll recall the same conversation and they'll give you different details. I've seen that a handful of times where something was written about somebody and then years later, somebody else from a different publication will revisit that same story and they'll come back and they'll get a slightly different interpretation of a conversation that happened or an anecdote. And I always, my head picks up on those because I have OCD and I'm insane about things like being in their proper places. And I just always kind of chuckle at those.
It's how the mind works. I mean, here's another example of what you're saying. I interviewed, a few years ago, I interviewed Jerry Murtaugh about the 1970 national championship team at Nebraska. He was one of the co-captains along with Dan Snyce. And I did this interview in, I did the interview in the year 2000. So it was 30 years before that they played for national championship. And Murtaugh said, you know, that President Nixon, Richard Nixon, who came to Lincoln to present a championship trophy to the Huskers, said Nixon was so rude that he wouldn't even shake hands with me, Jerry Murtaugh. And I'm looking back through photographs from the day that Nixon was here and presented the trophy, and I came across a picture of Nixon patting Murtaugh on the shoulder and shaking his hand. Okay, so Jerry didn't remember that had happened. I mean, his memory had changed what had happened there, but in fact, the picture showed that it had happened. You know, that he said Nixon wouldn't even shake my hand. He was rude to that point, but the fact is, he wasn't. They're both smiling and they're shaking hands. So your mind plays tricks on you, and you know, as time passes, I think you forget things or you remember them differently. Proust wrote, remembrance of things past is not necessarily remembrance of things as they were. And the older I get, the more I wonder about, you know, when I think back to times long ago, you know, how accurately I remember them.
Well, I have you on today because I want to do some remembering of the past and talking about things as they were. Would it be now 50 years ago? Not close to 60 years ago, about 50 years ago. It's Black History Month. It's February all month long, particularly in sports, teams, organizations. People kind of all throughout the realm of sports have been highlighting Black trailblazers and pioneers. And Nebraska, I noticed a couple of weeks ago on Twitter, they changed their profile image. They didn't do it on Instagram, which I thought was weird, but whatever. On Twitter, they changed their profile picture. Instead of the red block N, it is a black block N. And the header image is a tribute to the Magnificent Eight. Mike, you wrote a story on the Magnificent Eight in June of 2017. It was June 29th. I'm fumbling over my words here. You wrote a story about the Magnificent Eight. I want to talk to you about them. So you write kind of early on in the piece, they were racial pioneers. Though they weren't the first black athletes to play for the program. Later on, we hear from one of the Magnificent Eight, Jim Brown, and he's talking about Peony Park in Omaha. An amusement park that didn't allow black men and women to use the pool. And so Brown was already at Nebraska. You quote him saying, as far as I'm concerned, you could burn it, being the park, down. So let's start here. This collection of eight men, eight football players, we're talking about them today. Nebraska has showcased their story throughout Black History Month. So there's obvious staying power with their story, but they weren't the first at Nebraska. So what gives this group of men, what gives their story significance?
Well, I think, you know, I think just their presence, and one of the most prominent members of that group was Preston Love Jr. And I think that's probably where the story began, because I know Preston a little bit. I've exchanged emails with him on a fairly regular basis. And I first met him in person, I think, in Stromsburg, Nebraska, at the dedication of a section of the Stromsburg Public Library to George Flippin. George Flippin had a hospital in Stromsburg, one of the many things that he accomplished. And he's buried in Stromsburg. And anyway, there was a special day honoring him and dedicating that section of the library to George Flippin. And Preston Love was one of the people that was there. And he spoke. And, you know, he's a North Omaha activist. He ran for Senate against Ben Sasse as a write-in candidate. He was involved in Jesse Jackson's presidential run attempt in 1984. He helped in the campaign for Chicago Mayor Harold Washington. He's just a very active individual in black rights, and he's an Omaha Tech grad. Omaha Tech no longer exists. But I think that the kind of personalities probably had something to do with that perception of the Magnificent Eight. I think he's the one probably, as near as anybody could recollect, he was the one that gave him the nickname the Magnificent Eight, which was a play off of the movie, 1960, I think, released somewhere in there, the Magnificent Seven. So, I think the roster going into the season included maybe 44 players, eight of whom were black. There's a picture, a distinguished picture of them with Bob Devaney, those eight. And I think, again, the profile, the emphasis, because I believe that the previous season in 1963, there might have been more black players on the team even than that. But the perception, as one pointed out, I think it was Jim Brown pointed out, the perception at the time was if you were black and you were at the university, you were almost certainly an athlete. And there was also this perception within the state of Nebraska, and the population of the state of Nebraska was the population was in Lincoln was 130,000 at that time, but not a high black population. And, the state basketball tournament was held on campus then at the Coliseum. The finals were all at the Coliseum. That was a big deal. You know, some of the early rounds, I think the Class A played on the main court, and then there was a freshman court that ran at one end of the Coliseum, and they put a big partition. Really, it wasn't a solid partition. It was just like a curtain that separated the two, and they played a smaller class game over there, so there could be two games going there, and then they played some of the other games at one point at Pershing Auditorium. But big thing was to play the championship round at the Coliseum. And when people would come in from these smaller towns, Jim Brown said that, you know, it was a curiosity to see these black student athletes on campus because they had never seen black, there weren't black people in their communities. And at the time, if you watched television, you didn't see very many series shows that included any black characters. And, it was regarded as they were almost like a novelty, you know, that that people didn't know how to react to them. And again, the perception was, and with some accuracy, that most of them would have been athletes. Not everyone, though, that's the thing. So, you know, they were seeing these things, and these eight gentlemen were all successful afterwards. And I just think their presence kind of emphasized where things were at. It's not like anything was solved in the mid-60s. I remember in the student yearbook, the Cornhusker, I think 1971. I was thumbing through that looking for some stuff about the, you know, that would have covered the 1970 team. But I found a section in there, and I don't even think it was in the sports part of the yearbook, in which a handful of Husker, black Husker players on the team were interviewed about what it was like to be black and be on the football team in Nebraska. And one of the answers, Johnny Rogers said, you know, the experience was fine, except that, you know, there wasn't much of a social life available to the black student athlete. Another one who asked not to be identified, so it was wasn't an identified player, said he felt like the black players had to play twice as hard as the white players in order to get on the field. And if you look at the 1970 national championship team, for example, most of the black players on that team were either starters or they were so far down the depth chart you couldn't find their name. There were some outstanding players on that 70 and 71 national championship team, black. Johnny Rogers, Willie Harper, Donnie McGee was on one of those teams. Darryl White was on one of those teams. John Adkins. They played prominent roles, but you know, it hadn't been resolved by the 70s. I mean, and you know, if you look at the national championships in the late 90s under Tom Osmer, obviously lots of black players contributed, and by that point Nebraska was playing black quarterbacks. Obviously Tommy Frazier had a significant impact on two of those national championships under Tom Osmer. And Nebraska didn't have a regular black quarterback until Turner Gill in the early 80s.
You talked to some of them. You've got quotes in this piece. I'm gonna read a quote now from Willie Pascal. We were still trying to come up from being second class citizens, he said, trying to get the other white population to understand that. I think through football, we were able to accomplish some of that, end quote. You cite there was a 276 page city yearbook from 1964 that featured only four pages where photos show people of color. Three of those four images are sports related. And you've got Jim Brown quoted as saying, quote, "We were objects of fascination to a certain extent." I understand that the times that we're working in, but these still caught me in your talks with these players, these men. What was the mood as they were kind of remembering these times? Was it sort of like, you know, laughing through some of the memories? Were there painful or tense moments? Kind of take me through the process of just reminiscing on this stuff with them.
Well, you know, Willie Pascal was from San Antonio, Texas. Jim Brown was from, from Omaha. Preston Love was from Omaha. Harry Wilson was from Steubenville, Ohio. Langston Coleman was from Washington, D.C., one of the earliest walk-ons at Nebraska. Ted Backer was from Washington, Pennsylvania. Tony Jeter from Wharton, West Virginia. Freeman White was from Detroit. I mean, these guys were from all over. And I only talked to three of them, I think, in part because of the space that I had to write the story, and in part because it was difficult getting in touch with some of them. And, you know, at that point, Langston Coleman had passed and so forth. But so the ones I talked to, and I didn't, during our conversations, there wasn't bitterness. It was more of a matter of fact kind of a thing. And you know, it was like, I remember Willie saying something to the effect of, you know, after the story came out, he was appreciative that they had the opportunity to tell the story. I'm not sure that the pain that might have been there, that they would have necessarily shared with me when they when they told these stories. And maybe that's why I had difficulty getting a hold of some of them. Maybe they didn't want to talk to me. I've encountered that in some situations. But I thought that the storytelling was very direct and detailed. And again, we're talking about remembrance of things past, but I talked to each of them more than once, it was just an enjoyable opportunity to allow them to tell a story in whatever way they wanted. I mean, Willie had his high school had been integrated not all that long, I believe, and yet, even though it was integrated, there weren't many people of color there at his high school. He was a military son of a. His father was in the military, and after he committed, I think this is in the story, but after he committed to Nebraska, he it was a New Mexico State, I think, came calling, or New Mexico, one of them, and had an offense that was comparable to what he ran in high school, and he would have preferred to go there, but his parents both said, no, you've made a commitment to Nebraska. We follow through on our commitments. We don't back out. So you're going there. That's where you committed. So he said that he followed up on it. And once he got here, he knew he couldn't leave because the same pressure or whatever expectation from his family would have said, no, you're not leaving. You're going to stick it out. You're going to do what you said you were going to do. He brought up an interesting thing. One of his first concerns when he got to campus was whether Nebraska had a chapter of Kappa Alpha Psi, a black fraternity. It did, and his father had been a member of that fraternity in his college days. So he that was something that gave him a sense of being involved with people immediately, helped in the transition. Even though you can't find, when you take a yearbook, Cornhusker yearbook, and you look at it through those years, there is always a section on fraternities and sororities, and each fraternity has its section, and then you see all of its members listed, and in many cases, little pictures of those members and so forth. Kappa Alpha Psi was never acknowledged in any of those. And, Preston Love said that it wasn't acknowledged, and they met in a dorm. They didn't have a fraternity house at that point, but the fraternity existed. I mean, it had been established in 1916 in Nebraska, that chapter. And in 2016, they had a commemorative event indicating 100 years of the existence of the fraternity on campus, that chapter. And there's a large boulder outside the student union that commemorates it now. Getting back to your point, I think that they probably felt some of those things, but even when he said he'd like to see, would have liked to have seen Peony Park burned down. Jim Brown doesn't come across, and when you talk to him, as a violent person. He didn't say that with anything other than just, I would have liked to have seen it gone because it didn't allow us to be involved in that. And I'm rambling here a little bit, but the previous year, and all these guys would have been on the previous team, also the 1963 team, and that team went to the Orange Bowl and played Auburn and defeated Auburn 13-7, the Orange Bowl. And after the Orange Bowl, there was a big event that was held at a country club in Biscayne Bay area. And there was a trophy presentation, and I think the Frank Morrison, the governor of Nebraska, was there, and George Wallace, the governor of Alabama, was there. Kurt Gowdy, I think, was the master of ceremonies or whatever. It was just a big event, big glamorous event. But the black players on Nebraska's team weren't invited. They had their own celebratory party, probably at the team hotel, which the team hotel, the Ivanhoe, which had been newly remodeled, when Nebraska got to Miami, and the Ivanhoe was on Miami Beach, the manager said, you know, they had to ask Bob Devaney, do you have any black players? Devaney said, yes, we do. And he said, well, that's fine, not a problem. The team got there, and the manager said to Devaney, we've got some people staying here that have asked that if the black players could stay away from the pool and the lobby, because they would just be uncomfortable with that. And Devaney said, no, we can't ask for that. We'll find another hotel. And so the manager relented and said, well, okay, you know, we're good with that. So these guys were among those players on that 1963 team that had gone through that experience. And again, they had every right to be bitter about things, but they didn't share that bitterness with me when I talked to them. I mean, they were just, they seemed to be appreciative of the opportunity to tell their story. And, you know, I wish I could have talked to some of the other members of that group, but again, the space that I had and the difficulty in tracking some of them down or getting them to respond, I stayed with the three.
One of the quotes that you have in this piece that really stuck out to me was from Jim Brown, where he said, and if you were a black football player, you weren't a quarterback, safety, center, or middle linebacker. And I think this stuck out particularly because, you know, it feels like black quarterbacks still have such a higher bar to clear. Like this morning I was rereading some of, I mean, you could call it like hit piece style stuff that was said by anonymous scouts or sources or whatever about Kyler Murray before the NFL draft a couple years ago. You know, a guy like Lamar Jackson couldn't throw when he was going into the NFL. You know, like dual threat black quarterbacks have to change positions, but a guy like Tim Tebow, who I love and will not tolerate Tim Tebow's slander, but I think it's within reason to say that there were issues with him passing the football. He's a first round selection. And we kind of see this in the coaching world too. It's sort of all over the place really, but we just saw it with David Vanderpool getting passed over in Minnesota for the Timberwolves head coaching job. You know, when I read that quote, the positions that he kind of singled out, quarterback, safety, center, middle linebacker, there's one kind of common thread with those positions, a stereotype that they have to be the smartest guys on the field, that they're the controllers of the game, so to speak. And there are some who still think that black athletes can't succeed there. I'm curious, did you guys talk about that at all? Did you talk about maybe some of those issues that they ran into in 1964 that are still sort of prevalent today?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that in 1963, Nebraska had a black quarterback. He was down depth chart, Henry Woods. He got in a game or two, because I remember seeing a clip of a game in which at the end he got in and threw a touchdown pass. I forget what the game was. But he was gone the next year. He transferred, got out of there, and then Nebraska didn't have a black quarterback until, realistically, Nate Mason was recruited in about 1979, 78, somewhere in there. And, he and Ricky Simmons came up from the same high school. And then it was the next year that Turner Gill was recruited. And Turner Gill, I've said this many times, but I think Turner Gill was the seminal figure. He was the one that turned everything around at Nebraska as a quarterback, the perception of what a black man could do at quarterback. Turner could, he could have been just a straight drop back passer. He could have run more than he did. He had the ability to run. But Tom Osborne had decided that, not having a whole lot of success against Oklahoma, the way to beat the Sooners is to play the way the Sooners play, and that is to run some sort of an option offense. And I'm looking for a quarterback that has some experience that can do that. Turner Gill kind of fit that mold. And, the thing that I remember, it came down to Nebraska and Oklahoma on which school was going to get Turner Gill. And Oklahoma had tried to tell him, according to what Turner told me back then, Oklahoma had said, look, if you go to Nebraska, they'll never let you play quarterback. They'll move you to defensive back. He believed Osborne. He came to Nebraska. As I said, he set the standard, I think, for option quarterbacks. It was all progression from there. And you saw it in guys like Steve Taylor. Jerry Godowski, 1 year that he ran the option, was a remarkable season that he had. Steve Taylor, as I said, was a three-year starter, saw some action as a true freshman. He was an important figure in that development. All of this leading up to Tommy Frazier and what Frazier was able to do with the option offense. But it wasn't an easy thing. I mean, we're talking about the 80s before it gets going at Nebraska, the development of that option quarterback. And, Eric Crouch ran the option, won the Heisman Trophy. Scott Frost was the first Nebraska quarterback to have 1,000 yards rushing and 1,000 yards passing the same season. The guy that followed Eric Crouch, Jamal Lord, often gets dismissed. He did a great job. He was in a difficult position because he was following a Heisman Trophy winner, an Omaha guy, an in-state guy, what do you have to do? He didn't have as much around him as some Nebraska teams. He had a lot on his shoulders. He responded very well. I thought Jamal did exceptionally well two seasons and is in the discussion when you talk about the, outstanding quarterbacks Nebraska's had. But again, it wasn't an easy thing. It was a difficult path to go. But I always appreciated Tom Osborne's ability to look at things and adjust. And, I think that was an area in which he adjusted from where things had been. When he took over as the head coach, and he'd been effectively the offensive coordinator before that for Devaney, but Devaney never gave anybody the title. But after 1968 and, back-to-back 64 seasons, they needed to have some change in the offense. And then, so he basically turned it over to Tom, and Tom started working with the spread. And then, Tom was a receivers coach. So his focus was more of a passing related kind of a thing. And his first two quarterbacks when he was head coach, most prominent ones were David Hum, who was a great passer, and Vince Ferragamo, who transferred from California and was a great passer. And so he had to make some adjustments. But part of that adjustment was a matter of race and the willingness to play a black man at quarterback.
You talked about space with this, and you kind of constrained a little bit with what you could report and what you could write just based off of I mean, every journalist has gone through that, just space. When, in talking with these guys, was there a story or an anecdote or something that maybe you wanted to include that got left on the cutting room floor? What's something that you found interesting in talking with them that didn't get necessarily included in your piece?
Well, I think the anecdotal stuff was pretty much as I saw it. I'd have to go back and look at my notes now, but Preston Love is a great storyteller. His story is, I grew up in Nebraska. I followed athletics. I always enjoyed the state basketball tournament. You know, that was a big deal. And I have a recollection of when he played at Omaha Tech and Tech made it down to the state tournament and, you know, that kind of thing. So there were aspects of his, you know, what he did in high school and the players with whom he played at Tech and so forth. And just the tradition there and his relationship with Ernie Chambers, Senator Ernie Chambers, for whom I have had tremendous respect, you know, as kind of the contrary voice in the state legislature for so many years. You know, he kind of represented a side of things that was underrepresented, obviously. I even got a kind letter from Ernie Chambers when I was at the newspaper commenting on a positive way on one of the stories that I had written. But So Preston Love talked a lot about his experience growing up in Omaha that wasn't covered in that story, even though I acknowledged some of it wasn't covered in that story. And I think there's a lot to be told there. I know that Dirk Chatelain of the Omaha World Herald did a book about that part of Omaha that, it produced some tremendous athletes and people that fought a lot of difficult times to get where they were. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think if we talked about Gail Sayers a whole lot. You know, he was kind of from that time too, and he went to Central. I think he was a year older than Jim Brown. And I think Jim and I could have talked a little bit more about that than we did. It was interesting because Sayers didn't go to Nebraska. Bill Jennings couldn't get him there, and that was one of the reasons, I think, that at least an element of Bill Jennings being dismissed as coach was losing somebody like Gail Sayers to Kansas. So, Jim Brown said initially he wasn't all that interested in Nebraska either, but because of the reputation. But when Devaney came in, that was a whole different kind of a thing. I think Devaney had a little bit better ability to deal with the black players. He came from Saginaw, Michigan. Bob was kind of a rabble rouser in his youth, I guess, and he was a boxer. And I don't know. I think he just related a little bit better to the black players, and you know, he brought in probably more. I'm trying to think. You know, Jennings had some black players, and actually, Jennings' recruiting class was the one that helped Devaney get things turned around right away. You know, Devaney, when he got here, said, "Hey, the players that we've got here are pretty good." You know what? They need to be. The coaching needs to change a little bit, and the facility needed upgrade. That was one of the things. But you know, Willie Pashaw was here before Devaney got here. He'd been recruited already, and he's a freshman in 1961. So, I don't think there were specific stories that come to mind. I'm sure that if I looked through my notes, there were things that I would have liked to. Would have liked to have included, and particularly Preston Love's a great storyteller, so I'm sure that he could have filled out the story on his own.
Yeah, you have him quoted as saying that eight black players was a big number. The full quote, that was a very large number. It speaks to what was going on in big time college football or college ball. Eight on a team, that was hot stuff. So there's a pretty straightforward line from that to where the name came from, like why they are referred to as the Magnificent Eight. But I think you said this in the beginning. Do you know, or is it like, is it pinned down who specifically first referred to the group as the Magnificent Eight, or where the actual nickname kind of traces back to, who the first person was that said it? Was it Preston Love?
Well, that seemed to be the consensus, that it was Preston that came up with that idea, which again fits with what I took away from my discussions and what I've taken away from the times that we've talked or traded emails or whatever. I think that there's some certainty there, but you know, it's one of those things again, I think that you don't remember exactly, you know, as I said, I think the story started with Preston, and it may have started also with the photograph, seeing that picture with those eight guys and Bob Devaney, and being curious about that. Now I know, you know, I've looked through the 63 media guide, and I looked through the Cotton Bowl program, and there were a couple more. There were more than eight black players on the team in 63, but I don't know that, you know, the Magnificent Eight wasn't just a name. Those guys were all guys that had, you know, made significant contributions. I mean, they were prominent guys. They weren't like backup guys or down the depth chart. And again, it's difficult, you know, if you weren't a starter, or you weren't capable of being the guy on the field, it was difficult for you to be on the team. And I think that, I really think that that impacted the numbers to some extent, you know. It's just like, well, you better be ready to start, with limitations, as you pointed out with that quote about, you know, certain positions you weren't going to play that. And I know that, you know, another thing that Preston had told me, or that Preston said, was that, you know, if you were a halfback, for example, like Harry Wilson, Willie Pashaw played both offense and defense, but I think he kind of settled primarily as a defensive back. But a lot of times, if you were a black running back, and it made a difference whether you were the right halfback or the left halfback in Devaney's system, typically what would happen is all of the blacks would be, that black halfbacks would be at the same, on the same side. You know, they'd be competing with each other for that same position. And that made it difficult for them as well. So, you know, there were a lot of things that seemed to be built into the system. And, you know, part of that story for me, the context of part of that story is the entire context of black student athlete in Nebraska. Going back, you know, through the Bill Glassford era, you know, when there was that's when the first, well, from 1913, when Clinton Ross played for Jumbo's team in 1913 until 1954, Nebraska didn't have a black football letterman. There was one, as near as I can tell, there was one black football player after Clinton Ross, but before Charles Bryant in letter 1954, Tom Carradine, who got on the field, who started a couple of games in 1951 after transferring from Loyola of Los Angeles, missed the third game because he had bruised ribs, but he was dismissed from the team by Bill Glassford after that for skipping class. And it turned out that that's why he had been dismissed from Loyola of Los Angeles. But there's a lot of controversy about that, about Tom Carradine. That's one of the stories I'd like to do at some point, if I can find enough information about it. It's difficult sometimes. But think about that. And there was an unwritten rule at the university starting in about 1917 that blacks couldn't participate in extracurricular activities. And that wasn't lifted until, well, probably the late 40s or, and again, Charles Bryant in 1954. Leonard and Charles was from Omaha South. And I remember, I interviewed him on a couple of occasions before he passed. I was very fortunate. And he shared a lot with me. And one of the things he said was people in South Omaha told him, don't go to Nebraska. You'll never get an opportunity there. And he was stubborn enough to go. And he ended up lettering in football a couple times and wrestling. And at the same time he was there, then John McWilliams came from Sydney, Nebraska, and lettered for 3 years in football, 1 year in track and field. And the interesting thing there was that John McWilliams, his freshman year, he didn't have a scholarship. The scholarship system was much different, in the early 50s. The people of Sydney, Nebraska paid for his way when his freshman year. So he could come down to Nebraska to play football. He was always appreciative of that. Then there was another a black football player on those teams, Sylvester Harris, who never earned a letter. He was from Kansas City. But, and so that's Glassford, that's Bill Glassford's era. And that there just weren't that many black student athletes at the University of Nebraska for that long stretch of time. And so we're on 64. We're still not that far away, and not a whole lot has changed. And that was, again, that's what sort of made the Magnificent Eight so interesting, and their willingness to discuss it and talk about it, because you have to take it in context, and you still haven't got things all that resolved. I mean, it's better than it was during that shutdown when the university. I don't think it was a written rule. I think it was just taken for granted. But blacks were prohibited from being involved in extracurricular activities, sports primarily. What a difficult thing. And then even then there were problems within the conference when Nebraska did return, did allow that to happen. There was still some, there were still problems. When Nebraska played in Auburn in that Orange Bowl, the 64 Orange Bowl after the 63 season, that's the first time Auburn had ever played a game against a team with black players. 1964, you're talking about. And, it boggles the mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I would encourage everybody to go read Mike's story. It's on HailVarsity.com. I'll link to it in the description for this podcast that gets posted to our site. But obviously, you guys won't see that if you are getting this podcast from like iTunes or Spotify or Google Play or whatever. It's simply called The Magnificent Eight on HailVarsity.com. I would encourage everybody to go read it. Mike's a wonderful storyteller. Mike, it's always a joy to just sit and listen to you share stories and talk about this program's history. So thank you for doing that. I appreciate you coming on the podcast. I'll let you get back to your day.
Hey, thanks to you, Derek, and be safe, everybody.
That's going to do it for the podcast this week. I would also encourage all of you guys, the various Nebraska Twitter accounts, so for the different sports teams, have been sharing this week Black Husker history videos highlighting past, we'll call them pioneers, in their various sports, people of color. And they're doing a really cool thing where it's narrated by current players on the team talking about sort of the story, the legacy, the impact of black former Huskers. And they're informative videos, and they're well worth kind of giving them a watch. So there's been one on bowling, there's been one on baseball, there's been one on softball. And I would assume that there are more coming. The Nebraska football account also tweeted a video. It's 5 minutes long. I would encourage everyone to go watch that, talking about the Magnificent Eight. So, you know, one thing I always talk with people about, like, Black History Month is in February, but, you know, it's all year long. You know, there's never a bad time to share stories of trailblazers. So we'll be back next week with another podcast. In the meantime, keep reading hillvarsity.com. Go watch those videos that I said. Go read Mike's story. Read all of Mike's stories. He's great. And we will be back next week. Thanks, guys.
A Huda Media Production.